This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second of three parts of the Stephen King ranking from Desert Highway Radio. I'm Thomas Crowder. If you're just tuning in and you didn't listen to part one, that's an interesting choice, but welcome anyways. We're going to go ahead and get right into this episode, picking up exactly where we left off. So thank you, and I hope you enjoy. Number 43, 6 out of 10, Revival, 2014. It follows Jamie Morton, who first meets Reverend Charles Jacobs as a small child at a New England town in the 1960s. Jacobs is a charismatic minister fascinated by electricity. After a personal tragedy destroys his faith, Jacobs leaves the ministry and becomes obsessed with the experimental electrical secret electricity devices that he claims can heal and even bring dead people back from the grave. Over the decades, Jamie, now a struggling musician and drug addict, crosses paths with Jacobs multiple times, each encounter pulling him deeper into Jacobs' dangerous obsession. The climax reveals... Oh, I don't want to go ahead. I did not realize how much of that I gave away. So, I'm going to leave it at that. It is... Some people are going to have this way high on their list. Some people are going to have this way low on their list. I would consider this novel somewhat polarizing. I do think there's a lot of good elements to this. I think it is very slow burn horror because, again, you've got decades worth of material here, and there's just every time these two characters meet up, it gets worse in some way, shape, or form. Not the book itself, but just the circumstances are worse. I think the atmosphere is very strong, very Americana. I think the time periods play a heavy role in the atmosphere, and I think it does a good job. And if nothing else, the memory or the ending was memorable. It is a very interesting ending. And I think the character work, it's interesting. You know, Jamie, our main character that we follow, I think he's believable. I think he's a good narrator. I think he does a good job of kind of showing where he's at and why he thinks humanity is flawed. And I think his voice is well done. And I think the influences are very Lovecraftian for this book. And I think that that can help it in some ways. But the middle sections do drag on, pretty common with Stephen King here, and I would say that the ending is very abrupt, and some people love it. I personally wasn't a huge fan of it. The novel is very bleak. It's not going to make you really happy when you finish it, and I think one of the most interesting characters in it is our former minister, Jacobs, and I don't think that he is used enough. I think there is way too much of the book where he is not involved, where I think his involvement would only go to enhance the novel. So I feel like a lack of him does hurt it. Not that Jamie's bad. It's just the two of them together are the most interesting parts of the book by far. Number 42, 6 out of 10 here. We've got The Gunslinger, which is the first Dark Tower novel written in 1982. Now, the novel follows Roland DeChain, the last gunslinger, as he relentlessly pursues the man in black across a barren, dying landscape. He meets Jake Chambers, a boy from our world who has mysteriously appeared in Roland's. The journey tests Roland's morality and obsession and leads to a fateful choice. The book ends in a way that you definitely know there's going to be more to this. And I think, you know, it introduces this quest for the Dark Tower, which again is somewhat confusing upon that first novel read, but does get fleshed out as time goes on and more books come out. It's very unique. It is, for a Stephen King novel, it is strange. You've got this Western fantasy post-apocalyptic genre, which I think does really good. I think it's a very interesting, you know, take. You got this very interesting atmosphere, which I think what hurts The Gunslinger and why it keeps it from being higher up on the list is in that first outing, you're confused by a lot of things. Like you're not going to get a lot of answers. You're kind of just thrown right into the middle of this very mysterious world. You don't get to know a lot about Roland, which again, kind of like Han Solo, he's very complex. You know, he's not your traditional hero. And so, you know, it's interesting, but you're not going to get a lot of answers there. And there's a lot of foreshadowing. You can tell that this novel was kind of thrown out there with the hopes that it would become more if the book was popular. It was. And we build this huge universe out of it. But again, there's not a lot given to you yet. You've got this mythic quality. And it's interesting. The narrative does start to meander. It is a slow read. And again, you're not getting a lot. So you're very confused for a lot of the book, very minimal explanation. And Roland himself is not a traditional like Stephen King protagonist where you know a whole lot about him and you love him. He's very cold. And emotionally it's very hard to connect with him. The one thing, obviously, when it comes to the Dark Tower is as the series goes on, a lot of those issues are resolved and you really fall in love with the series. King said that The Gunslinger was inspired by Robert Browning's poem, Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came, and Sergio Leone's Dollars trilogy featuring Clint Eastwood, which is why I think for myself as well, no offense to Idris Elba, I love him as an actor, but when the Dark Tower movie was announced, we all, Stephen King readers, I think we all had this idea of Clint Eastwood in there. And, you know, Clint Eastwood by that point in time was definitely not going to be the Roland we wanted him to be. So no matter what, you were just going to be a little upset. And obviously the Dark Tower movie was garbage anyways. I didn't even bother to watch it because you are not going to be able to tell this story in a single movie. It is built for at best, you're talking a limited series. But I think you could get away with some seasons of this to really get it page to screen. It did have a very fragmented original version from 1982. I personally read the 2003 revised edition, which I think smooths it out. It helps with those connections that you're going to get later on in the series. So my advice to you would be to read the 2003 revised edition. I think it's in terms of starting that journey, it's just going to help a lot. Number 41, 7 out of 10. I think this is our first 7 out of 10 here. Gerald's Game from 1992. Jessie Burlingame and her husband Gerald retreat to a remote lake house for a weekend getaway. During a bondage game, Gerald handcuffs Jessie to the bed where their role play turns ugly. Gerald suddenly dies of a heart attack, leaving Jessie trapped, alone, and restrained. Well, not necessarily a heart attack, but yeah, whatever, read the book. As she struggles to free herself, she is battling hallucinations, childhood trauma, and this interesting figure called the Space Cowboy. Potentially a real world intruder, potentially something of her mind. It's hard to gauge at the beginning. And the novel blends this survival horror, psychological stuff, as Jessie fights not only for her life, but to confront a lot of her, you know, repressed memories. This is a very claustrophobic book. Again, it's a 7 out of 10, guys. We're into that category where these are good books. Like I recommend everything, but this is where we really are going to get into the recommendations. I think everything from number 41 onwards, I will push heavily to people. So it all takes place in one room for the most part. You've got this relentless suspense. There's some heavy themes here. I'm not going to get too deep into it to not spoil anything, but you've got a lot of repressed memories for good reason. A very unique premise. You know, it's a simple, terrifying what if scenario. And Jessie herself is a very fun protagonist. I think she's strong. She's complex. She's resilient. You're rooting for her the whole time. The interesting thing about this one, for those of you that know or don't know, this was kind of linked, not necessarily twin novels like Regulators and Desperation, but it is linked to Dolores Claiborne, another King novel that is rock solid. You'll hear about it later. And I'll talk more about the links to that one later as well. Just know that there is a lot to do with an eclipse that happens in this book. And you've got a very slow burn book. Again, I know that can hurt it. For me, a lot of the reliance on Jesse's inner monologue, I found it intriguing. I think it helps to sell that novel. It's hard with when you're in such a claustrophobic single person in this one room. Like you do need that inner monologue. There's no way you're going to make a compelling novel without it. And it is disturbing. You know, it's very graphic, and the action's limited. You're not going to get a whole lot of it. And the ending, which I won't talk about, but it has to do with the space cowboy. Interesting to say the least. And again, if you have some strong opinions on that, I'd love to hear it. I personally did not like the space cowboy ending. I feel like the way that they handled that was the way that he handled that. I don't know. Wasn't a huge fan, you know, and I know for some people, especially younger readers, the space cowboy element of the novel played a huge role in the fear behind it. To me, it throws away a lot of the real world fear in place of this kind of strange one. And I think the novel would have done better without it. And yeah, we're going to, you know what? I will talk about the Eclipse stuff now. So when King wrote Gerald's Game and Dolores Claiborne, it was supposed to be this bigger experiment of novels called In the Path of the Eclipse, where it kind of would explore female protagonists trapped in moments of crisis. Now, Jesse's moment of crisis that happens during the eclipse, I'll let you read the book to find out. But it happens, that same eclipse is also happening when Dolores Claiborne is having her very big crisis moment in her novel. And I think it's an interesting concept to where these two women actually link to each other psychically in both novels, experiencing each other's trauma. It's an interesting thought. And I would have been interested to see what King could have done had he kept doing novels with that theme behind it. So number 40, we've got his first ever novel, 7 out of 10, Carrie, 1974. Carrie White is a shy, bullied high school girl living under the control of her fanatically religious mother. When Carrie gets her first period in the school shower, her classmates cruelly mock her, triggering the discovery of her telekinetic powers. As her torment continues, a well-meaning student tries to make amends and persuades her boyfriend to take Carrie to prom. But another bully plots a humiliating prank. And while that prank is carried out, Carrie will lose control, unleashing the telekinesis and causing a lot of destruction. So, strong debut. This was, for a first ever novel, it really did showcase a lot of what we were going to get as Stephen King's career continued on. You know, you've got this very good mix of horror elements with real world stuff. You've got a very sympathetic protagonist who you can, you know, really envision in your head with Carrie. And these bullying and abuse themes, something you see a lot in Stephen King. I think he did a good job with it in a unique format. And for those of you that don't know, and again, I'm not trying to spoil a lot, but if you don't know about the prom scene from Carrie, congrats on living under a rock your whole life. I mean, everybody knows about the prom scene. And if nothing else, you cannot tell me that that is not just such a lasting, iconic scene from a novel. The prom scene is one of, you know, horror, cinema, literature. It is such a famous scene that King was able to do in his first ever novel. I think that speaks a lot to his abilities as a writer. And I think the format's very interesting. When I read Carrie, I read it way late in the game. I'm talking, I read that within the last year. I don't know why I wanted to wait so long. It was one that I just felt like I knew a lot about it already. I tried to avoid as many Stephen King movies as possible before delving into these. Like, obviously everybody's seen Shawshank, but like, I didn't watch Green Mile until I read the book. And I tried to do that for a lot of them, and I'd never seen the Carrie movies yet. I know there's been a couple of them, mainly because I didn't want to ruin any sort of inkling of what the novel might be. But yeah, everybody knows it though. That's the problem. It's like The Sixth Sense. Everybody knows it. And so, you know, when I went and dived into this book, I was surprised with how it was told. I did not understand or know prior that the book is told through, you know, partly through newspaper clippings, reports, interviews. It does feel like you're reading a documentary film, which honestly, I think helps to really establish a King voice. One that he doesn't use a lot in terms of that format, but very strong first outing. And I was surprised by it. I did not see that coming. Now, King himself is the first one to say that the writing's a little uneven. It's rough in places. And again, it's his first ever published novel. Would I consider it predictable? It's hard to say whether or not the novel's predictable. When you come into it so late into the game and you know so much, it's hard to sit back and say, well, I saw that coming. Like, would I have seen that coming had I had no prior knowledge? It's hard to say. And again, you got a little bit of limited character development. You don't get a whole lot outside of Carrie and her mom. A lot of the other characters are very one-dimensional. And again, it's for a first novel. It doesn't have a lot of the depth that we would get from Stephen King later, but again, still a solid book. Number 39, 7 out of 10, Du McKee from 2008. So Edgar Freemantle, a successful contractor, suffers a traumatic brain injury in a construction accident that leaves him with memory loss, rage issues, and the loss of his right arm. To heal both mentally and physically, he moves to Du McKee, a remote island off the coast of Florida, and he discovers a newfound talent for painting. But his artwork begins to take on a supernatural power. Influencing reality in frightening ways, he befriends two other island residents, Wireman, one of my favorite side characters, a caretaker with his own tragic past, and Elizabeth Eastlake, an elderly woman with fading memory who knows more about this island's dark history than she lets on. As Edgar's art grows stronger, it awakens an ancient evil tied to Du McKee, and Edgar and his friends must confront this force before it consumes them all. So right off the bat, the character development in this book is awesome. Edgar, Wireman, Elizabeth, they are such human characters. They're very emotionally compelling. They're fun. I enjoyed these characters quite a bit. I think the setting, too, is awesome. I think Du McKee itself is really cool. It's lush. It's eerie. There's this, you know, overall mystery behind it all. And it was such a nice change of pace. I know Stephen King readers will agree with me. To have a book not in Maine or that general kind of vicinity was so nice. To go from, you know, this always interesting, you know, Castle Rock and Derry and all that to this tropic Florida setting was such a nice change of pace that I really enjoyed. He did it again in one of his more recent short stories, Rattlesnakes, which for those of you that don't know, came out with the Some Like It Darker book or You Like It Dark. I don't remember off the top of my head. Which Rattlesnakes short story in there takes place in Florida. It has references to Du McKee. Fun fact, though, it is a sequel to Cujo. So if you did not know that Stephen King had written a short story sequel to Cujo, he has. It's called Rattlesnakes. It's in his most recent short story collection. Phenomenal book. Short story, I guess, but phenomenal stuff. The book does an interesting job on blending horror with healing. You've got this meditation on trauma, recovery, and creativity, but a lot of the things that, you know, help heal these characters are also what gives into the horror. So it's a double-edged sword. You've got this creeping suspense. You know something's off. You're getting pieces of it here, there. I think it's very well done. And I think it is, out of his works that came out between 2000 and 2010, it is one of his strongest. I know a lot of people will have this in their top 10. Some people hate it. I don't. That's your problem. But I understand, though, that there is some pacing issues. It does start very slow. The middle section slow. Again, not the first time I've said that. It is very long. It's 600 pages. Some people think it's overextended. I think he does a good job with that length, but I get it. And it's got familiar elements. You've got haunted creativity, evil artifacts, things like Bag of Bones and Rose Matter touch on those things as well. I do think this handles it better than those books, but to each their own. And you've got an ending that some people don't like. I definitely think, you know, the ending was fine. Do I think it's one of his best endings? No, but I was so happy with the characters and all the other things that I could look past a lot of that. But some people feel like that climax doesn't live up to the buildup. And I totally get that, which is why it's, you know, number 39 on the list. Now, number 38, 7 out of 10, Firestarter from 1980. So Andy McGee and his young daughter Charlie are on the run from a secret government agency known as The Shop. Years earlier, Andy and his wife participated in a government experiment with a hallucinogenic drug that gave them psychic abilities. Andy developed a mild mind control power called the Push, and while Charlie herself was born with a terrifying pyrokinetic ability, the power to create fire with her mind, for those of you who don't know what pyrokinetic means, and the Shop wants to capture Charlie and harness that power as a potential weapon. Andy is trying to protect her, and Charlie struggles with the responsibility of her abilities. They grow more destructive the more they're used, and eventually she is captured. The agency does everything they can to unleash her full potential with catastrophic consequences. So the one thing you can say about this book, it is fast-paced. You've got that government conspiracy action, supernatural horror, and there's a lot that happens in this book. You've also, again, bias here, but you've got a father-daughter dynamic. And again, I have four kids. I have two boys, two girls, but me and my daughter are very close. So immediately when I'm seeing this young girl and her dad, it just resonates with me. And their bond is a huge part of the story. The emotional weight plays a large role in it. And it's sympathetic for these people. You know, you got this protagonist, Charlie, who's powerful, but vulnerable. She's very compelling in terms of, you know, this is a young girl. It's a lot of responsibility on this child. You've got an exploration of power and exploitation, themes of abuse of power, child innocence, government corruption, and a hell of a climax. But you can definitely remember the ending of this book. Now, on the con side, you've got a repetitive chase structure. There is a lot of that. You know, you're running from one place, you're hiding, you're running from one place, you're hiding. I get it. You've got a one-dimensional villain in terms of just this overarching the shop. And some of the bad guys just kind of feel like, you know, classic government goons rather than nuanced characters. I get it. The outcome, you could call it predictable if you want. I think the trajectory, you know, her growing powers, you know, that's coming, but I don't think necessarily that the ending itself is predictable. A lot of people who are looking for that traditional Stephen King stuff, you know, this is definitely more sci-fi thriller than it is horror. So I wouldn't go into it expecting a horror book, but again, I want to preface this. If you're a Stephen King fan and you've read a lot of his books, you should be the first one to know that the man is not just horror. He is responsible for some of the best non-horror works of art that we've ever had. Shawshank Redemption, which is not going to be in this list because it is a novella, but that's a huge one. Green Mile we'll talk about as well, which I guess you got a little bit of supernatural there, but it's not a horror book. Life of Chuck, which was recently made into a movie, a solid short story, solid movie, not a horror book. To just chalk him up to horror would be an insult. He is a lot more than that. So for people getting into Stephen King, don't think that the man just writes pulp horror. He is so much more expansive than that. 37, 7 out of 10, Gwendy's Button Box. So we haven't talked about this one in a while here, but Gwendy's Button Box came out in 2017. In 1974, 12-year-old Gwendy Peterson of Castle Rock, Maine, meets a mysterious man in black named Richard Ferris, which for some people they think is potentially Randall Flagg. If you're a King fan, you know exactly who Randall Flagg is, but you never know 100% one way or the other. This gentleman, though, Richard Ferris, he gives her a strange box with colored buttons and levers. Now, I'm going to explain the box a little bit. I don't think it's too spoiler heavy. The box dispenses silver coins and chocolates that make her healthier and sharper minded. However, the buttons on the top can cause death and destruction on a massive scale. Now, Gwendy grows up with the box, enjoying its gifts while wrestling with the temptation and the responsibility it brings. She realizes the box has a dark will of its own, testing her morality. And the story explores whether she can resist the corrupting influence or what it means to carry such a burden. So, right off the bat, if that doesn't sound interesting, I don't know what does. I remember reading the description of the book before buying it, and I was like, wow, that's a hell of a setup. I'm kind of bummed that it's just a novella because it is a very small length book. But the whole story about this power, temptation, responsibility, the box itself, and just the way that King designed it with Chizmar as well, I just think it was such an interesting premise. And also you've got another book taking place in Castle Rock. So again, for those of you who like when he kind of connects his universe like that with these familiar settings, you've got Castle Rock again. I think Gwendy as a character is really fun. I think, you know, in her second and third outings, it's less so, but I think as a child, it's just fun to watch how a child would handle such responsibility. And again, you're talking 175 pages-ish, very quick and easy read. And it's a fun story too. You know, one that I don't think necessarily needed a second and third book. I think it was a very self-contained story that was fun, but it worked well. And then you've got, obviously the co-writing here was at its best. Chizmar's straightforward style, I think blended really well with the atmosphere and character development that Stephen King does. But it definitely feels like a novella. Like I mentioned, it was for such an interesting premise and setup. It did kind of suck that it was only so much. But at the same time, we ended up getting a second and third and they were lacking. So I guess maybe they were onto something when they did that. And then the box itself, very vague in terms of what it is and how it came to be. That probably frustrated a lot of folks. I would totally understand that. But to me, I enjoyed it. I thought it was fine. Very light on horror, more or less like a dark fairy tale when compared to other things. And the resolution, you know, it's very neat and tidy. I think, you know, some of the Stephen King stuff is a little bit more complex. I personally thought this was fine. Again, you know, you've got the first one in a trilogy. I also mentioned before about Richard Ferris, a very mysterious character that shows up in this book. And a lot of people think that this might be a reference to the Man in Black figure from the Dark Tower series, as much as a lot of other things. Randall Flagg being the main one from The Stand as well. You know, mainly it's when you get the initials RF. A lot of us Stephen King fans kind of jump all over that. But Stephen King, he originally wrote the opening and then handed the project to Chizmar, who finished the draft, marking one of the few rare Stephen King collaborations. And we're going to talk more about some of the other ones that I think are just done better. Number 36, 7 out of 10, Blaze. This came out in 2007. This is the seventh and final Bachman book. I think I wrote a little bit more about that on here as well. No, but I'll talk about it when I finish up with this description. So, Blaze follows Clayton Blaze Blaisdell Jr., a physically large but mentally slow man whose life has been defined by tragedy and exploitation. After suffering childhood abuse and a head injury that stunted his intellect, Blaze drifts into petty crime. He partners with George Rackley, a small-time con man who dreams up schemes. When George dies, Blaze, still hearing George's voice in his head, attempts their final plan, kidnapping an infant son of a wealthy family for ransom. While on the run with the baby, Blaze begins to develop a tender bond with the child, showing the depth of his humanity despite his criminal actions. The novel alternates between the kidnapping and Blaze's heartbreaking backstory, leading to an inevitably tragic ending. So, again, if you didn't pick up on it, this has got a very similar Of Mice and Men kind of tone to it. Reading this book, that was the first thing I thought of is, oh, this is Of Mice and Men, but with a ghost story. And I think that's an okay thing. I think that actually helps the novel a bit. I think it's a fun, you know, way to read this. And Blaze himself is you got an anti-hero. I mean, you can't really be a hero when you're kidnapping infants, but he is, you know, you have compassion for him. You know, this is a man who, like I said earlier, had an injury that stunted his intellect. He is slow. And I think it helps this story to where, much like in Of Mice and Men, you know, you have this very compassionate, you love this character, but, you know, he has his flaws and he's going to have a hard life because of, you know, the special need that he has. And there's a lot of emotional depth to it. I think the novel itself is much more of a character study than it is a thriller. I think the explorations of loss and loneliness are really well done. It's a pretty fast read, and I think it's a fun crime story as well. Definitely not traditional horror. There is a lot of elements with that in terms of his partner and whether or not this is a voice in his head or an actual ghost. You're not going to get a ton of answers there, but I think that helps the story. You can look at it as predictable in terms of just the kidnapping itself, but I think because that plays, you know, such a side role to the backstory that you're getting, it's okay. And again, you can look at the Of Mice and Men thing and think that that's a recycled theme. I don't think it is. I think it's a remix that does really well. It's bleak. Classic Bachman, right? You're not going to get a very happy-go-lucky story. Stephen King himself, he wrote Blaze in the early 70s before writing Carrie, but he shelved it thinking that it wasn't very strong. And so when he eventually rediscovered it later, he released it under the Bachman pseudonym, called it the last Bachman novel. And there's a fun preface in the novel about, you know, how he found it amongst Richard Bachman's old things and decided to release it. I think it's an interesting way that he did the release of this book. And it's a very good one, too. Number 35, 7 out of 10, Sleeping Beauties, 2017. In a small Appalachian town, and soon across the world, a strange phenomenon begins. Women fall asleep and become wrapped in a mysterious cocoon-like gauze. If disturbed, they lash out violently. Men are left behind in a growing, chaotic world struggling to maintain order. At the center is Evie Black, a mysterious woman who seems immune to the sleeping sickness. She may be the key to stopping, or choosing the fate of, the world. The novel becomes a battle of genders, morality, and survival as society begins to fracture under the crisis. So, I know for a lot of people, they're going to think I put this one way too high. I very, very much enjoyed Sleeping Beauties. And this is one, another co-creation between Stephen King and his son, Owen. You know, he has some other stuff that he's done with a lot of other authors. I think this book with his son, I think it's really well written. I think the premise is very unique. You see a lot of post-apocalyptic stuff, but this whole concept of, you know, the men are left behind, the women are gone. Again, I mentioned before, I'm a comic book reader, and this book immediately gave me vibes of Why the Last Man. If you haven't read Why the Last Man, And that's just the letter Y. Do yourself a favor, read that series. So good, but it's kind of flipped, right? In that world, in that story, the men are all gone. And the women are all that are left behind. And that is one of the best comic series you'll ever read. And I think this novel evoked a lot of the same feelings I had while reading that. I do think Why the Last Man is much better, but I do think this one's fine. I think Evie Black is a character. There's a lot of mythical energy to her. It's interesting there. You got a lot of big themes. And I think the father-son collaboration worked really well because they have two very different styles that I think blended together. But to me, one of the best parts about this was the world building. You know, it starts off in this small town setting, but you know the global stakes. But it's interesting to kind of stay focused, unlike The Stand, where you get a lot of the world in some of those chapters and in this soon-to-be released, well, actually, I think it just came out, this other book that kind of explores the world of The Stand a little bit better. This one is very laser focused on this small town, but you know the rest of the world is falling apart too. And I think that's an interesting way of doing it. It is a long book. You know, you're looking at around 700 pages. Some readers, I'm sure, think it's a little too long. I think it was fine. I know a lot of the critics said that the social commentary on gender was pretty heavy-handed and one-dimensional. I didn't find that to be the case. I thought it was fun. And a lot of the critics also pointed out that there was a lot of flat male characters that are painted as violent, dumb, or caricatured, frustrating a lot of the male readers. Again, I'm a male reader, and I didn't quite feel that same way. And there's a lot of interesting tones that you're getting with this. You're getting supernatural horror, social allegory, and a lot of soap opera stuff, which for some didn't mix well. I think some elements definitely didn't. And the mixed reviews on the ending there. I think the resolution, it did lack a lot of the emotional punch that the setup had, but overall, I think it's a fine novel. Number 34, another Dark Tower book here, 7 out of 10. We've got Wolves of the Cala, came out in 2003. It is the fifth Dark Tower novel. Again, you've got Roland DeChain. He is arriving in Calibrin Sturgis, a frontier farming town, with a dire problem. Every few decades, the town is attacked by wolves, mysterious riders who steal one child from each pair of twins. The children are later returned, but left mentally broken and physically stunted. The Quartet, which is the group of everybody, Roland and his gang, agree to help defend the town while also dealing with larger plot threads that I'm not going to dive into without, spoiling a bunch of stuff. This book combines fantasy Western horror and a samurai-style showdown that leads to a climactic battle against the wolves. Right off the bat, this novel is all about giving you Akira Kurosawa vibes. You know, this is seven samurai told in the world of the Dark Tower, which, for some people, that is already hook, line, and sinker, you're in. And for me, I loved it a lot, which is why it's so high on this list. Again, the world building continues within the Dark Tower. I think this one also links directly to another Stephen King book. I won't say how, but Salem's Lot plays a huge role in this book. And I think that, to me, you'll see where Salem's Lot ends up on this list. I love that. You're also getting a blend of genres here. So you got the Western gunslinger and the samurai style story, which I think they blend really well, which is why you see things like other Kurosawa style samurai movies that have now been turned into things like The Magnificent Seven and all that stuff. You've got some moral complexity, good character development with Roland and Jake and Susanna. There's some issues in terms of the pace. It's a long book, and a lot of it is set up. The wolves themselves are interesting when you get to know them more, and I think they are a little underwhelming. And there's a lot of backstory. Like I said, if you haven't read a lot of the intertwining novels, you're going to miss some pieces here and there within this one. And some people, you know, when it comes to the entirety of the Dark Tower as a whole, they can view this novel as slowing down the momentum. I definitely had feelings of that, but I wasn't certainly hurt by it. I think, you know, upon that first time read of Dark Tower, you do want to finish it. You want to know what happens. And this one is kind of like a side quest, and that can throw you off. King himself said that the film Seven Samurai was a huge inspiration. You definitely read that when you read the novel. And a fun thing in here too. So the wolves, they have a lot of weapons and technology, straight out of Marvel Comics universes. You got lightsabers. I think there's some Harry Potter stuff in there if I'm remembering correctly. So you've got a lot of King multiversal connections there, which, for some people can completely take them out of the book. To me, I thought almost like fun Easter eggs, which, you know, you don't think you're going to get in a Dark Tower novel, but hey, there they were. So, you know, it was an interesting read. Number 33, 7 out of 10, Cujo from 1981. So here we go, another fictional town of Castle Rock, Maine. Cujo tells the story of a lovable St. Bernard who contracts rabies after being bitten by a bat. As the disease takes over, Cujo transforms from gentle family pet to terrifying killer. The main storyline follows Donna Trenton and her young son Tad, who become trapped in their broken-down car during a heat wave while the rabid dog stalks them outside. In parallel, the story explores themes of family struggles, infidelity, alcoholism, and fate, showing how ordinary problems can collide with sudden horror. The climax is terrifying, tragic, cementing Cujo as one of King's bleakest early works. So, right off the bat, my own personal thing with Cujo, I think it speaks volumes to Stephen King's ability to write when you've got this story about a rabid dog terrorizing this family. And there's, again, this B plot of, you know, infidelity, and I won't get too deep into it, but there are moments in this book where the infidelity B plot is way more intense than the rabid dog trying to kill this family. And it's not to discredit either storyline. I think, if anything, it goes to credit, much like I said earlier, how well this real life horror can coincide with, you know, this out of this world, not out of this world, but a rabid dog is definitely not a normal everyday thing that you're going to deal with. And they're both so intriguing. And I think the way that King was able to do both of those plots together to where they both were having you like kind of on the edge of your seat, it speaks volumes. You know, the story itself is very realistic. There is a lot of tension in this. The emotional impact is huge. And the character work is so well done. Those three characters, Donna, Tad, and her husband, Vince, I think I'm going to be honest, I'm spacing. It's also 10:11 PM at night on August 27th. But, again, it is just, those characters are so good. And you've got that small town depiction of Castle Rock, which again is very authentic. The ending is, you know, bleak. You know, the whole story is bleak. Some people could say it's a slow build. I think the family drama is so well done. I don't believe that personally, but I do want to read as much of the cons as possible to give this ranking as much credibility as I can. You've got some repetitive sequences when it comes to the trapped in the car scenes. I think, again, they just add tension. And a lot of the characters are hard to root for. That is one thing. Again, it's a pro and a con. You've got unlikable characters, but I also think that that's what makes this novel endearing and realistic. And again, some authors or some critics found it a little too simple compared to some of his more ambitious works, but I don't know. I think it helps to give the story some authenticity. Number 32, 7 out of 10, Fairy Tale from 2022. Charlie Reed, a 17-year-old boy burdened by trauma from his mother's death and his father's alcoholism, stumbles upon a secret gateway to another world. After befriending an old recluse, Mr. Bowditch, and his aging dog, Radar, Charlie discovers a magical well in a man's backyard that leads to Empus, a dying fantasy realm plagued by a curse. Radar is rejuvenated by the magic of Empus, but Charlie soon realizes the world is overrun with monsters, political strife, and a looming darkness known as the Nightmare. Charlie is thrust into the role of reluctant hero, facing trials, rescuing captives, and confronting evil forces while grappling with the cost of courage and the weight of destiny. It's part coming-of-age tale, part epic fantasy adventure, with heavy nods to King's lifelong love of fairy tales and mythology. So here we go, another dog story right after the other. This one a lot more upbeat. Again, we've got a lot of epic world building. King is great at this. Empus itself is just a very interesting landscape. I loved a lot of our introductory scenes with Empus because it just went from, you know, one very interesting area to a whole twisted area. And there's a lot of dark fantasy stuff going on there. And I think King, this is one of his top fantasy worlds that I think he was able to create. I think he did a great job with it. The hero himself is very fun. I think Charlie's awesome. I think the connection between him and the dog Radar anchors the story very well. You got a lot of classic King voice in here with horror, fantasy, and character-driven storytelling. You got that coming-of-age story coming out there as well. And again, I think the genre mix works here. I think the dark fantasy and the horror work really well. Now, I will say it's a little bit of a slow start, but I loved Charlie's backstory. I felt like the buildup was necessary to understand everything. I think it was good. But I will say the pacing issues, I will agree with. The middle section does drag. It is interesting. It's not horrible. And I think the beginning and end of this novel are so well done that that's what kind of puts it so high on this list. You know, people can call it predictable. Again, it's familiar fantasy cliches, but I think it does it well. It is a long book. It could have been tighter for sure, especially that middle section, but you know, it is what it is. It has a little bit of references to some Dark Tower stuff. And I think the tone, and I'm going to talk about this book a little bit later, the tone is very comparable to The Talisman, which I love The Talisman. And I think well, we're going to be getting a third one, hopefully, within a year or so. And I'm very excited for that. But overall, I think Fairy Tale is a very good book. And it's one I do want to reread as well. Number 31, 8 out of 10. We got our 8 out of 10s now. The Running Man, 1982. This is the fourth Bachman book. Set in dystopian 2025, which is where we're at right now, society is ruled by a totalitarian government that broadcasts deadly game shows to distract and control the populace. The protagonist, Ben Richards, is a desperate man who volunteers to compete in the titular Running Man game to earn money for his ailing daughter. Contestants are hunted by professional stalkers while being chased across the country. Ben Richards uses cunning, strategy, and sheer determination to survive, exposing corruption and media manipulation along the way. The novel critiques a society addicted to violence, spectacle, and state control, culminating in a high-stakes confrontation with the forces running the show. This is, of course, also a movie starring Arnold Schwarzenegger that I refuse to watch because I can just tell it does not do any service to the book. However, as of right now, it hasn't come out yet, but we do have a new Running Man movie coming out directed by Edgar Wright featuring Glenn Powell. This looks to be way more faithful to the source material. I hope it is, because this is, again, one of my higher on the list books. But very fast-paced and thrilling. This is a very engaging novel. The dystopian look of the world, I think, is interesting. You've got this interesting media, celebrity culture, along with this authoritarian control. I think it's a very interesting world that that Stephen King was able to create here. And Richards himself, he's an interesting hero. I liked him a lot. He was very grounded, but he was desperate. And that's, I think, what made him sympathetic to a lot of people. And he was resourceful, too. He's fun to watch, or, well, I guess, you know, read and hear. But you've got a very high tension game. I think the game itself is very interesting. We're going to talk again about another Richard Bachman game show book kind of scenario a little bit later on. But it's interesting, right? You look at things nowadays like the Hunger Games series, and you can't tell me that they did not have a little bit of inspiration from some of these Stephen King books, especially the other one we're going to talk about, as well as The Running Man. You know, some people view the bad guys and the secondary characters as one-dimensional. I get it, but I feel like that plays well into how we're supposed to view them. And again, it's very violence-heavy. If that puts you off, then this is not the book for you. Some people would consider the plot predictable. I can definitely see elements of that. That is true. It's pretty short and simple. It does lack a lot of the nuance of King's more expansive books. But again, this is a Bachman novel, so we're not looking at it compared to straight-up King. And I will say the 1980s version of 2025 does feel a little bit dated. You know, not everything's going to be correct, but we're also looking at a dystopian future. It's not going to look like how actual 2025 was. But again, I think it was a great book. 8 out of 10, you know, that's pretty high regard. Number 30, 8 out of 10, Under the Dome from 2009. So, oh man, if you've only ever seen the TV show for Under the Dome, you shouldn't. In the small town of Chester's Mill, Maine, it's suddenly and inexplicably sealed off from the rest of the world by an invisible, indestructible dome. You know, think of the Simpsons movie for some visualization here. Residents cannot leave and outside help cannot get in. The story explores how people respond to crisis, focusing on the struggle for power between Big Jim Rennie, a manipulative and corrupt local politician, and others trying to maintain order. Food, water, and law enforcement quickly become scarce, escalating tensions and paranoia. As chaos and moral dilemmas intensify, the townspeople confront personal flaws, secrets, and the oppressive, possibly sentient force of the dome itself. The novel blends apocalyptic suspense, social commentary, and psychological horror, examining human nature under extreme pressure, and I think it does this very well. Now, the book itself, it's got a lot of high-stakes drama. Obviously, as you can imagine, the enclosed environment, it has a lot of tension and suspense in it. I think it's a very interesting character study. I think Big Jim Rennie is one of his best villains, so realistic in terms of just a power-hungry politician in a small town that, you know, just, you know, big fish in a small pond kind of scenario there. You've got a lot of exploration of human nature, greed, fear, heroism, selfishness, especially under the pressure of such a large dome. And of course, the plot itself, there's a lot of storylines that are interweaving with each other, showing how the crisis is affecting all these different people and these different scenarios. And I think it's really well done. And again, when you look at a small town, which is where I'm from, I think it does a really good job of tackling those politics, the media, religion, all of that within this small town microcosm. Now, it is lengthy. You're talking over 1,000 pages. There are sections that are going to drag on. That happens. Some people are going to love those sections. Others are not going to like them. There is a lot of characters. So, you know, if you're somebody who has a hard time dealing with dozens of characters in a book and maybe needs to like write them down or visualize some things better, that can be confusing. And it does hurt the focus of the novel from time to time. And it's a little, you know, unevenly paced. But again, it's hard with novels this big and so, you know, full of things. My issue, and I know a lot of people's issue, is the ending. I think it's anticlimactic. I think it is unsatisfying. I think it is what keeps this novel from potentially being in the top 10, which sucks. Because again, everything up until the ending was just phenomenal. But when you do find out the dome's origin, I mean, if you weren't underwhelmed or unhappy with it, congratulations, you are not me. I was not happy with the dome itself. Everything before that, so good. You almost kind of wanted them to not give the dome's origin because of what it ended up being. But again, feel free to let me know your thoughts. Number 29, 8 out of 10, Dolores Claiborne from 1992. The story is narrated by Dolores Claiborne, a tough, stubborn, working-class housekeeper in Maine who is being interrogated about the mysterious death of her wealthy employer, Vera Donovan. Dolores recounts her troubled life, including her abusive marriage, raising a difficult son, and her complicated relationship with Vera. Through her testimony, it is revealed that Dolores may have been involved in Vera's death, but the novel is much more about her inner strength, moral code, and survival than a traditional whodunit. The story alternates between the present and Dolores' past, exploring themes of domestic abuse, female empowerment, and resilience. Right off the bat, this is one of the... I mean, she is one of the best Stephen King protagonists. I think the first-person narrative and narration is really a good choice for a book like this. It's compelling. Her distinct voice comes out so well from the writing of it. I think she is very much a strong person that you feel as authentic, and that's a fun thing to have in a novel. It's very psychological. You've got a lot of deep-rooted issues with trauma, abuse, and just women empowerment, and I think it's really well done. It's a very character-driven story. A lot of focus is on Dolores being a first-person narrative, but you learn so much about the people around her as well. She does a good job of telling her own story within this book. And it's very tightly written. The novel is very concise. I don't think there's any pacing issues with a novel like this. And I think the resolution, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the ending. I think there was a lot of poetic justice. The closure was there. I think it was just really, really, really well done. Now, you know, obviously I'm going to give you some cons as well as his pros here. You can view it as limited scope with that single point of view. Maybe some people would like some other perspectives. I get that. You know, you can call it predictable, and I think there are elements of it that definitely are. And it's bleak. You know, I would say, again, it just depends on the reader here. And of course, this is the other one, like I had mentioned before. This novel is linked to Gerald's Game with the whole eclipse and the female trauma and empowerment. And I guess both are very good novels. I think Dolores Claiborne definitely takes the cake for the better of the two. But yeah, that's for you to decide. As you know, this is my ranking. I definitely encourage everybody who's listening to come up with their own reviews of everything. Number 28, 8 out of 10, Christine from 1983. Arnie Cunningham is a socially awkward high school student who buys a 1958 Plymouth Fury named Christine. Initially a fixer-upper project, Christine begins to wield a malevolent influence over Arnie, gradually changing his personality. Arnie becomes increasingly arrogant, cruel, and obsessed with the car. Christine appears supernaturally alive, capable of repairing herself and even harming those who threaten her or Arnie. Friends and family notice the changes, leading to a deadly confrontation as Christine's destructive nature escalates. The novel explores obsession, possession, and the dark side of teenage desire. Ah, man, I loved Christine. I'll be honest, when I started reading that one, I thought for sure I was going to hate it. I'm not a big car guy. I thought it seemed like a goofy premise, you know, because I knew it was a supernatural car, you know that. No, loved it. I mean, again, it's 8 out of 10, number 28 on the list. You've got that classic Stephen King horror. You got supernatural terror, realistic teenage angst. I think Christine as a car is, I mean, iconic. There's no other way to put it. Malevolent, sentient, and it's just what an interesting premise. Again, comes off goofy until you read it, and it's like, wow, this is actually really well done. I think the character transformation you see within Arnie is unsettling, but it also is, you know, realistic in a way in terms of just the confines of the novel. And again, it's very tense and suspenseful. I think the setting as well is very nostalgic. You got that 1970s, 80s Americana. I think that really adds to the atmosphere. You know, obviously, some people could consider Arnie's arc pretty predictable. I think there's elements of it that definitely are. Secondary characters, some are great, some are kind of underdeveloped, and that part sucks. And then, you know, you've got, again, the premise. You've got a supernatural car. It does strain believability. I get it. And I think, again, classic King, you've got some middle sections that definitely drag on. It gets a little repetitive with some of the repair and obsession sequences, and then that part does tend to wear on you. King himself said that he wrote Christine after seeing a 1958 Plymouth Fury at a junkyard, which, you know, of course, that's all it takes for this man to be able to write a gigantic novel about it. Number 27, 8 out of 10, The Talisman from 1984. 12-year-old Jack Sawyer embarks on a quest across the United States and the parallel world known as the Territories to save his dying mother. In the real world, Jack is a troubled boy, often on the run from dangerous people, but in the Territories, he gains special abilities and meets allies and enemies who mirror those in his own world. Jack must find the Talisman, a magical object capable of healing his mother while facing both supernatural and human threats. The novel blends fantasy, horror, and adventure, exploring themes of courage, family, and the duality of worlds. So, right off the bat, this does immediately bring into play the Dark Tower in terms of the Territories and how they are imagined and just kind of the way that they function. You've got a good hero's journey here. I think Jack's coming of age story is very compelling. I think it is just a very good adventure tale as well. I think it blends those genres really well. And although it is dark and it's got a lot of Stephen King and Peter Straub, who co-wrote this with him, it's got a lot of their literary stuff going on. I think it's got a very hopeful theme, which is good. The villains, I think, are awesome. I think some of the most memorable antagonists with the human and supernatural elements. You know, for some, you know, I know it is a longer book and some of those sections can dwell. I know that the whole dual worlds, real worlds and territories can be confusing. I totally get that. There was, I think because I read this after the Dark Tower series, I just kept wanting to compare it, and that hurt this novel in my own read. And so when I reread it, I had to drop that, you know, existing notion that I wanted to hold. I think there's a lack of action in the middle, which in a novel that is so action heavy with the world and a lot of the things that happened, it does throw it off a bit. And a lot of the minor characters are a little underdeveloped when they're not very important to the plot, which also can hurt it as well. But overall, I think The Talisman is great. I think it's a fun story. I think, you know, if you have kids or you're a younger reader, this is a great one to start with, personally, but that's just my take. So number 26, 8 out of 10, The Drawing of the Three, Dark Tower book number 2 from 1987. So after the events of the Gunslinger, Roland decides to continue his quest towards the Dark Tower, and he ends up getting wounded and stranded on a beach where he discovers three mysterious doors that pull him to three people from different eras in our world. So you got Eddie Dean, Odetta Holmes, or Detta Walker, and Jack Mort. And again, not going to get too deep into it, but each drawing that Roland has of these doors and everything helps the person overcome challenges, and it begins to form the Quartet, which is their group of heroes there. I think the novel does a really good job of exploring addiction, identity, and fate. The character development you get with Eddie and Odetta, they're just two of the best characters in this series, and it's fun to just see where they started from. You've got a lot of depth with the trauma and addiction side of things. And again, it really does do a good job of expanding the Dark Tower mythos and the multiversal stuff and how everything intersects. I think it's a good way of handling that. The action and suspense is awesome. The doors are just interesting, and each one you open is a fun read for us. You know, there is a lot of complexity with the book. Again, The Dark Tower is a very complex series, and so I know it can definitely be confusing for newcomers. I do not suggest you read The Dark Tower as your first ever outing into King. And the Odetta arc is, you know, it's a dissociative identity thing, and it can be a little melodramatic. There's also not a ton of villain development in this. In terms of just like Roland's quest, you know, the conflicts are very immediate. They're less memorable. So that kind of hits it as well. And yeah, like I said, there's not a lot of progression towards the tower, which is the quest that you get in this whole series. So it, again, you get some of that side quest stuff going on, which, you know, for those of you who really want to get to the end, you might be frustrated by this. For those of you who are here for the ride, this is a much more enjoyable novel. Number 25, 8 out of 10, Finders Keepers, 2015. Now, for a lot of people, I'm going to have the Mr. Mercedes trilogy ranked higher than you would probably expect. That is going to be a personal thing for me. I think that Stephen King does a very, very good job of blending horror with, you know, detective novels. And although Mr. Mercedes and Finders Keepers don't necessarily have a lot of supernatural elements, I also just think he does a really good job of crime novels. And I think for me personally, I enjoy some of that work as some of his best, and so that's why these are so high. Feel free to disagree with me. We all have different opinions. So former Detective Bill Hodges, now retired, is drawn – and oh, by the way, this is the second in the Mr. Mercedes trilogy. So former Detective Bill Hodges, now retired, is drawn back into the world of crime when Morris Bellamy, a fanatical reader obsessed with a famous author, is released from prison. Years earlier, Bellamy murdered the author to steal a hidden fortune of unpublished manuscripts. And when Bellamy learns that some of the manuscripts are missing, he goes on a violent quest to recover them. Hodges, along with his friend, Miss Holly Gibney, and Jerome, must track him down before more deaths occur. The novel mixes murder mystery, suspense, and psychological exploration while exploring obsession and the power of literature. So, again, strong character stuff. Like I said before, Holly is best when she is a side character. She is awesome in this. And Detective Bill Hodges is one of my favorite Stephen King characters. I just have this vision of him in my head as this grizzled old detective who does not give a shit about anything, but secretly does. He just doesn't show it. And he's fun. I think he's a fun character. I think Bellamy himself, the obsession that he's got, it makes him unpredictable, which makes him fun to watch and listen to and read and all that. And I think the suspense is really well done. I think the whole chase to recover the manuscripts, it holds really good tension for the book. I think the literary themes are fun. Again, that danger of obsession mixed with, you know, authorship and fame and art. I think it's really well done. It's accessible. It's tightly written. You know, some people will say that there's less horror, which hurts the book. I don't think so. It is limited world building for a second one in the series. You're not getting a lot of expansion on anything. You're just kind of following those same set of characters. And the events are very, you know, small scale, especially when compared to the first and third novel. But, you know, it is what it is. And the villain's motivation, some people don't think obsession is enough or it's just not fully explored. I think it does a good job, but I understand those who don't. And again, middle pacing, I'm going to say it 1,000 times, the middle does drag. Again, it's a direct sequel to Mr. Mercedes. It's followed up by End of Watch, and it's just a solid trilogy. Number 24, 8 out of 10, The Eyes of the Dragon, 1984. Again, a lot of people would have this one towards the bottom of the list, I think. Personally, I think Eyes of the Dragon is just so well written. You know, I'm a big Lord of the Rings fan as well. I think that Stephen King, you know, when faced with simple fantasy and not a lot of the horror stuff and not, you know, anything crazy big like The Dark Tower, I think he wrote such a good, you know, self-contained story here. So set in the Kingdom of Delane, the story follows Prince Peter and his younger brother Thomas. King Roland is murdered by his manipulative advisor Flagg, who wants to seize power. Thomas is framed for the murder and imprisoned in the Spike, a tall tower, while Peter must navigate court politics to save him. The story follows themes of loyalty, betrayal, courage, and justice as Peter grows into a responsible ruler and Thomas endures captivity. Unlike most King novels, this is high fantasy. No horror elements, aimed at a younger audience, but still engaging for adults. It is, again, it's unique in terms of it's just not what you get from traditional King. I think the moral themes are very clear. You got good versus evil, which I think does play into the fact that this was written for a younger audience. Again, there you go. There's Flag. He's back. This is one of King's most enduring and sinister characters. It is accessible. It's fast paced. I think the plot is engaging. I think the political intrigue and the adventure and just, you know, Thomas's whole story is just so well done. You know, it is simple characterization. They don't have a lot of depth. I don't think they need to in a book like this. You know, is the plot predictable? Sure. I don't think that hurts it though. Again, it's not complex. Don't go into this thinking you're getting some crazy in-depth thing. It is very straightforward. It's a small scale thing. It's fun. But again, you've got that connection to the Dark Tower with Flag. And I think this does appeal well to adults. It's a story that I pushed some of my older kids to read and they enjoyed it. You could almost even view this as part of like a spinoff maybe of Dark Tower with some of the elements of Delane and all of the King, you know, King's larger multiversal stuff. So again, fun read. Number 23, here we go. 9 out of 10, The Wastelands, Dark Tower book number 3. So now we are in the 9s out of 10. So we're getting some really, really good novels. Some of the best of the best. Roland of Gilead continues his quest for the Dark Tower, joined by his quartet, Eddie Deans, I'm not going to say this other one, and Jake Chambers. So this one is taking place directly after the drawing of the three. I think the quartet's bonding is awesome. I think you see a lot of development with all of them. You get into some very interesting villains in a very interesting land, City of Lud. Huge set piece with Monorail, Blaine the Mono. Gosh, it's hard to even start to explain some of the concepts that you get in the Dark Tower, but Blaine the Mono is one of the most interesting villains, I guess you would say. The one thing about this book too, is it ends on a major cliffhanger. I remember just thinking in my head, luckily I read it after all the Dark Tower books had been released, but if I was reading as they were released, I probably would have been very frustrated here. But again, you've got strong character development. All of the characters are just becoming fully realized, which is fun. The world building is huge in this book. Midworld becomes much larger than you imagine. I think the adventure and the stakes are really high. Again, the genre is really well blended. You know, obviously it's got a little bit of a slow start. The ending is very unresolved with the cliffhanger, which I know frustrates a lot of people. And again, it can get confusing and overwhelming. This is a hefty, hefty book, but it's okay. And I think, you know, there is much less of a focus on Roland and more on his cohorts, which doesn't hurt in a large series like this to have focus on them, but some people would view it as a problem. But overall, I think it's a phenomenal book. Number 22, 9 out of 10, End of Watch, 2016. This is the third book in the Mr. Mercedes trilogy. So retired detective Bill Hodges and his partner Holly Gibney face their old nemesis, Brady Hartsfield, from the first book. Not going to give a whole lot of information about how that comes to be, but just know that it is very much a lot of callbacks to the first book, which I think does help a full circle ending here. But it is a very emotional conclusion. You've got a good blend of genres with the detective thriller and now some supernatural stuff as well. Holly's growth is huge, from especially when we first meet her, and it really sets her up for her next appearance in The Outsider, which is a novel we'll talk about as well. Very fast paced, very suspenseful. You know, there's a lot of fun themes that they explore in here, and there's a huge shift in tone from the first book. From the first two books, again, you're going from gritty crime thriller to more supernatural stuff, which for some people I know can be a turnoff. For me, I enjoyed that shift. I felt it was well earned and I enjoyed it, especially knowing that Stephen King was the writer behind it. I felt it was in good hands with that. I think the final showdown was a little predictable, and, you know, with the villain himself, I could have gone with a completely different one, but I also was okay with it. I just, to me, it was, I don't know, his whole storyline is a little strange, but overall, not horrible at all. I think it was a very, very good book. All right, and that's where we're going to cut it for this part 2 of 3 for the Stephen King book ranking of Desert Highway Radio's own Thomas Crowder, myself. If you liked what I had to say, then you're really going to want to hear part 3 to hear my top 10 and my number 1 overall pick. I'm sure you're going to dislike it because all of us Stephen King readers have some very different opinions on things, but I appreciate you listening thus far, and I hope to catch you in part 3. Out now.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.